The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we'll be on the line with three members of the Independent Investigations Group who take fringe science, paranormal, and other extraordinary claims and expose them to the brilliant light of science. And speaking of science, if you're listening live, today is Darwin Day. For those of you that don't know, that's February 12th, and it's the anniversary of the birthday of evolutionary biologist Charles Darwin. It's an opportunity for us science-loving folk to get together, talk about the life and discoveries of Darwin, and how they affected the way that we understand the world. And generally, we just celebrate the fact that we've been able to evolve as much as we have. There are Darwin Day celebrations happening all over the world, like Darwin Fish and Chips in Louisville, Kentucky, or lectures like The Arms Race at a Snail's Pace in Ithaca, New York, or the Phylum Feast and Mud Puppy Night in Bishop's Mill, Ontario. And some celebrations are small gestures that can have a much larger impact. Here's an example. Intelligent design, which is basically a watered-down form of creationism used to confuse people into thinking there's some kind of scientific controversy around the theory of evolution, which there is not, is frequently shelved in the science section of bookstores. This obviously is a problem for many, many reasons. Portland State grad students have started a petition about this that puts it quite succinctly. As scientists, we feel strongly that categorizing intelligent design as science is both inappropriate and misleading. Local bookstores and libraries unintentionally exacerbate this misleading characterization when they shelve ID books and legitimate science texts in the same section. Our goal is to convince the U.S. Library of Congress to reclassify ID books into sections other than the science section, which is an honorable goal, and I hope they do well with that. But unfortunately, that will take time and lobbying and meetings and such, while intelligent design books still sit on the same shelves as books by Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking and Richard Feynman. And unless science is leaking into the ID books by osmosis, they're still in the wrong section. So, some people have decided to take this into their own hands. There's a bit of underground activism going on. There are people who are heading out to their local super mega bookstore and reshelving the books themselves. And one of these people writes about it on the dispersalofdarwin.wordpress.com, written by Michael Barton, who goes by Darwin's Bulldog on Twitter. And let me just read you a bit of the post on his last reshelving trip. Every time I go into the Hastings bookstore here in Butte, Montana, I get annoyed to see anti-evolution books in the science section, especially since these books are not scientific in their anti-evolutionism, but motivated by the intelligent design movement or other religious factors. So I usually remove the books from the science section and reshelve them in the religion section. Usually I find the books eventually returned to the science section, and wonder if the bookstore employee returning them ever thinks, why did these particular books keep ending up in the religion section? So I keep moving them. Today I went to Hastings and I had my camera with me. The copy of Signature in the Cell I moved a few months ago was in neither the science nor religion section and was probably purchased. Today I moved The Edge of Evolution and The Darwin Myth away from the shelf directly under where copies of Dawkins' The Greatest Show on Earth were, and placed them next to, I just had to, The Adventure Bible and The Princess Bible in the religion section. And he's taken pictures. Now, while I thought this was a cute and potentially helpful, possibly only symbolic act, unless you happen to be the bookstore reshelver, some people apparently view this much differently. In a follow-up post, he tells us that his subversive action attracted the attention of John West, a senior fellow of the intelligent design think tank, the Discovery Institute. On their blog, West writes in a post titled, "Vandalizing Bookstores and Censoring in the Name of Darwin." Whatever Barton claims, his actions constitute censorship, pure and simple. Barton is trying to hide books he doesn't like in order to prevent others from being exposed to views with which he disagrees. Indeed, he is apparently so insecure about the ability of Darwinists like Dawkins to make their case that he thinks he has the duty to vandalize private bookstores in order to keep the books of Darwin's critics away from the public. Barton's activities are not only juvenile, they may well be illegal. Censors like Barton aren't doing Darwinian evolution any favors. They merely prove to the public just how bigoted and intolerant the Darwinist establishment has become. Much like certain global warming fanatics, Darwin ideologues increasingly place themselves above the law and try to exempt themselves of any sort of real accountability. So I feel that there may be a bit of hyperbole here. There was no vandalism, nor censorship. There was public relocation, let's say. But it's the rest of that that I'm actually more curious about. I don't think it's a surprise to anyone that I'm interested in skeptical activism. So is this an effective form? Is moving books that are not science out of the science section a responsible act that could possibly help to limit the amount of people who think that intelligent design is somehow more valid than the idea that the Earth is 6,000 years old? Or is it symbolic? A harmless way of keeping our spirits up while we're fighting the good fight? Or is it juvenile and serves only, as one commenter on John's blog said, to make us look like whiny crybabies? There will be links and such to the posts I've mentioned at skepticallyspeaking.com, so check them out and do leave your thoughts in the comment section. As always, let's start off the show with speaking up. Today we have the return of Joey Haban, author of Disability Skepticism and Assorted Geekery-related blog, newly nerfed. Welcome back, Joey.
Thank you. It's nice to be back here.
So you're here today to talk about superstition.
Yes.
Do tell.
All right. Well, the reason I was thinking about this is because my first appearance on the show was on Friday the 13th. And I thought that this was the perfect day for someone like me to be on the show. Because when I read anecdotes from new skeptics and new atheists about the difficulty they have casting off their old beliefs that have been deeply ingrained, this really resonated with me because of my history with superstition. And the main one that continues with me till right now that I can't get rid of is that keys on a table bring bad luck. And I'll get more into that a little bit later. But I grew up in a mostly secular Jewish family, and both of my parents are critical thinkers. But my mother's mother was very superstitious, and that some of that got passed down to my mother, and some of that got passed down to me. Although I did protest it, I have a very strong memory of, I think I was in high school, telling my mother not to freak out on me about keys on the table, because I didn't want to grow up believing in this stuff. But it didn't work. I grew up believing in it. So, oh well. But since I do give people grief for having irrational beliefs, I decided it was only fair that I pay attention to mine. So I have to reject superstition in thought, word, and deed. This is what I decided. Thought meaning that I consciously monitor myself for signs of magical thinking. And I never really believed in sort of the standard superstitions like black cats and ladders and breaking mirrors and those kinds of things. But it still does sneak in a little bit, and so I'm just trying to be more aware of that. In word, it's like I still say good luck or knock wood the same way I say, oh my God. But I say that I don't have to kneel down and actually pray. They're just sort of linguistic remnants. And for me, personally at least, they don't signify anything. But on the other hand, not saying things because you might jinx them, now that seems to be more of a problem because that actually is connected to magical thinking, and that's something I'm trying not to do also. And then deed is, for example, actually knocking on wood when you say knock on wood. And in high school, I had to knock on real, actual wood when I said knock on wood. And I would like to be more smug about the fact that I've ruled all that stuff out of my life now, except that I still can't put keys on the table. So this is, I think, my last real vestige of superstition, because consciously, I don't believe in this. I don't really think that if I go and put a key on the table, something bad's going to happen. And I don't really think that if something bad happens, it's because of the key on the table. But I still, there's still like a discomfort in, or this feeling of unease if there's keys on the table. So I feel like in order to go into rehab for this last thing, I'm going to put my car and house keys on the dining room table tonight, and I'm going to leave them there overnight. And this is my hope, that it's going to be casting off the last shackle of this this last big superstition for me.
Oh, this is wonderfully symbolic.
It is mostly symbolic, yeah.
and well, okay, let's go with the other than symbolic. Do you think there's going to be actual repercussions?
I do not think there will be actual repercussions. I'm sure something will go wrong tomorrow or tonight, and I think I can keep myself from believing that it's because of the keys.
I support that. So actually, I wanted to know. Now, you say bad luck if you leave your keys on the table. So what does that entail? Like, could that be anything from, you know, like a forest fire in the field next to your house to stubbing your toe?
This is a funny thing about this superstition, is that it was never made clear to me exactly what the bad luck was. So I kind of ended up developing my own rules about it. Like, well, if I'm in a house belonging to someone else and they put their keys on the table, it doesn't bother me. It's not my house. It has to be, you know, my house or my room. When I was in high school, if it's there, then something will happen. But I don't really know what the specifics are. And I guess that's what the great thing is about superstition, is because it is so open-ended that way.
So there are, you know, more and less harmless superstitions. This, to me, falls into the less harmless category. So
definitely, that's partly why it's so annoying to me, because to believe in something like this is so silly, and I wouldn't make such a big deal about it if it weren't sort of the, like I said, the strongest hold that superstition has had over me. It's not like I feel like I have to get rid of it because it's a harmful belief for me, but it's more like as you said, a symbol that I still have this magical thought going on, and it needs to go away.
That is totally understandable, and I admire your bravery, and I hope nothing at all goes wrong for you in the next 2 days. In fact, I hope you have the most brilliant next couple of days, just to prove.
Well, thank you. Yes. It would be nice that way, but if anything goes wrong, I'll really try not to blame it on the keys.
We do want to know how it goes, actually.
I'll report back.
Wonderful. And thanks so much for being here, Joey. And
thank you for having me, Gil.
Thank you also, honestly, for showing people that being on Speaking Up is so enjoyable that you wanted to do it twice.
It is. I recommend it highly.
So those of you out there with something to say, or an event, or a podcast, or a blog, or a group, or something to promote, we're more than happy to give you your very own soapbox. Send an email to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. Put Speaking Up in the subject line. Let us know what you'd like to talk about, and we'll contact you. Please do be patient, because the more of you that listen to the show, the more email we get, which is so many kinds of awesome that I can't even tell you how many kinds of awesome it is, but it also makes me not quite as prompt with my responses as I would like to be. So, we'll be right back with the Independent Investigations Group right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including Citywide LP 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY, Kootenai Cooperative Radio 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia. CIVL 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia. CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario. CLHI, Rosslyn Radio 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia. Freethought Radio and WPRR Public Reality Radio 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with three members of the Independent Investigations Group in Hollywood, California. IIG's most recent public activity was their $50,000 challenge of Anita Ikonen's claim that she was a medical dowser. So we have Spencer Marks, who's been with the IIG for 4 years now and has served on the steering committee for the last three, and in his other life owns an electronics installation company. He held the position of wrangler for the Anita Ikonen test. Jim Newman is with us as well, who has written about ghosts and monsters for television, scripts for cartoon shows like Casper in Toonsylvania. He was one of the lead investigators and protocol negotiator on the recent challenge. And Steve Muscarella, whose background is in film and TV production, is on his second term as a steering committee member. And Steve worked with Jim to design the sort of nuts and bolts of the administration of the test. He also videotaped the entire challenge. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, all of you. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for inviting us.
So, Spencer, you've been with IIG the longest. Tell us a bit about the organization.
Well, it's an all-volunteer organization. Currently, we have about 40 members. I think my numbers are correct. I think we have six of us on the steering committee, Steve being one. And we are a very eclectic group. We have all kinds of backgrounds and skills. But the one thing we have in common is we have a belief in critical thinking and looking at the world in a rational, scientific perspective.
So the IIG, is it affiliated with or run by the Center for Inquiry, the Critical Thinking Advocacy Group?
Well, it's kind of a difficult thing to explain. Mm-hmm. We're housed out of the Center for Inquiry. We are an independent group, hence the name Independent Investigations Group. Mm-hmm. We are not really controlled by CFI, but we are connected in the way of being housed in that building and so forth.
Okay. So in addition to offering the $50,000 to anyone who can provide evidence of any paranormal, supernatural, occult, power, event, anything like that, you also do unsolicited investigations. And you've done some interesting ones, the Billy Meyer UFO case. And I was looking through that particular case, and it's hilarious, actually.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about it, but I'm not the expert by any means. The expert on that is Derek Bartholomew, and he's really done a great job of really looking into that case and debunking it wholeheartedly. The U.S. representative of Billy Meyer is a guy named Michael Horn, and he's quite a character, to say the least.
Well, I know that Derek is a member of IIG, and he's for listeners, he's also the guy behind the Jenny McCarthy body count website.
That's correct.
But maybe I'll give a couple of teasers to the audience because it's brilliant. On the website, it clearly shows that a photo of two people that Mr. Billy Myers claims are aliens were actually from a photograph taken from the Dean Martin variety show.
That's right, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the lady's name, but she was a dancer on the Dean Martin variety show, and apparently somebody took a photo off the television, basically, and then Billy Myers claimed that this was one of the aliens. I think the name was Astrad or something along those lines. And he was just, not only did Derek do a great job of finding where this photo came from, he actually tracked down the actual actress, the dancer, and he's spoken with her, and of course she is just, you know, beside herself, and she finds it very funny that they would use his or use her picture and claim she was an alien.
And it's Jim jumping in here for a second.
Hello, Jim.
We have to remember that Billy Meyer, or whoever took the photo from the TV screen, did it long before there was TiVo, long before there was commercial home videotape. I believe the picture was taken in the late 70s. So he thought, no one's ever going to see this photo or this image again, and little did he realize technology would catch up with him.
Well, there's also, you guys have reproduced the spaceships that Billy Myers has said are pictures of actual spaceships with, I believe you used a stick and a string.
Well, what we do, Jim Underdown, who is the chairman of our group, actually has a habit of going around the country. He travels quite a bit, and wherever he goes in the world, whether it's South Africa, Chicago, New York, whatever, he dangles this coffee lid basically off a stick and a string, and he makes those kinds of photos. It looks, I mean, they're very convincing. If you didn't know it was Jim doing it, you would say, oh my God, there's a UFO. And he can recreate just about any of those photos you see on the internet or wherever. As far as the Billy Meyer case goes, somebody has just recently completely, perfectly duplicated the model that was used for...
Oh, called the wedding cake?
Yeah, it's called the wedding cake UFO, and this gentleman in England found all the actual parts that was needed to create this thing with a lid like off of a 55-gallon drum was the base, and he put little Christmas ornaments around it, and he spray-painted it, and it's literally the exact reproduction. I mean, it's perfect in every detail, and he sent that, I believe, to Derek Bartholomew.
Now,
so we have that.
This fellow went so far as to make sure that the model could be built using one hand.
Yeah, he put his arm behind the back. Because Billy Myers actually has only one arm, and there have been claims that, you know, nobody could build a model or could take all these pictures if you only had one arm. Well, this gentleman, to create that, he literally tied one arm behind his back, if you will, and he built the whole model and took all the pictures using just one hand. So he was able to, I mean, perfectly duplicate those things. It's just amazing.
Now, you've done the Billy Myers case. You've also done something interesting that I just want to touch on, because I do really want to get to the $50,000 challenge. But in the November-December issue of the Skeptical Inquirer, fascinating article about...
The nurses,
the California Board of Nursing, it requires that nurses take mandatory continuing education classes, but it seems like there isn't very much oversight, because you guys were able to create and submit a course called Feng Shui for Home Care Providers.
Well, let me give you a little background on it, because originally we simply went to the nursing board and said you shouldn't be licensing people to teach courses that are... that are basically pseudo-scientific, and they didn't really listen to us, and we got frustrated, and we were almost in a position where we didn't know what else to do, when someone came up with the idea that if our beef was that they would license anything, why don't we be that anything and see if they will license us?
Right.
That grew into the feng shui idea, because we thought it might sound like something that they might go for. And they ultimately did. It's quite a long story, but they ultimately did bite. And they certified us to teach feng shui for nurses. We eventually announced that we were going to be doing it, and they got wind of what we were up to. But by then, the ball was already rolling, so to speak.
And you actually did hold the course, even though they eventually rescinded their approval.
Absolutely. And some of the things, so the listeners can understand what this course was, it wasn't just feng shui for nursing. We actually submitted for their approval, the state's approval, such things as Chinese Sheyu. Well, if you're if you translate that into English, it literally means snake oil. Shayu means snake oil. And we said, we'll be teaching these things, moving furniture around. We had terms like mobile kinesiology. Well, mobile in German is furniture. So basically, we're saying we're teaching furniture moving. And we also made up a word. We said we're going to teach canopiary flexibility. Well, the word canopiary doesn't exist anywhere that we can find in any language in the world. And so we just threw in all these just ridiculous things. Another thing was anthropomancy, which was my personal favorite. Anthropomancy is the ancient art of disemboweling usually a live human being and reading the future by where the entrails lay.
Ah, lovely.
Yeah, so we basically were telling the state of California we're going to teach nurses to disembowel live humans so they can predict the future based on how the entrails fell. And then the California Board of Registered Nurses said, yeah, that's fine. That sounds like a perfectly good, acceptable course to teach. Again, like Steve said, they caught wind of this and immediately sent us this note saying, oh, by the way, we licensed you in error. We need to stop now. You're not licensed anymore. But by their own rules, they have to have some kind of viable reason.
Right.
They provided no viable reason whatsoever. So it's still in limbo. There's more to come on that.
So listeners, if you are listening live on CJSR and you have questions, give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com. And if you're on Twitter, do tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Now we have the main attraction, the $50,000 challenge. Jim, can you give us some background on that?
A little on the challenge generically, because I'm mm-hmm. the newest member of the three of us.
Yep.
But I understand that it started as a $10,000 challenge, and then at some point about 4 or 5 years ago, it was bumped up to $50,000. And as far as I know, before we tested Anita Ekonen, there was just one, or were there two previous tests?
There were probably, I think, just two. Very
okay.
few.
And so, but Anita applied for this, for our $50,000 challenge, and she became quite a presence on the James Randi Educational Foundation forum. James Randi, if your listeners don't know, is a magician, and he offers a $1 million prize if you can prove that you have paranormal abilities. But there are a lot of hurdles to overcome to take his test. It's a lot easier to get to us. And so Anita came to us first, but she joined James Randi's forum. He has a very active skeptical forum that anyone can join and discuss things. And she became, I don't know if darling is the right word, but she generated tens of thousands of posts.
Is that unusual for people who are interested in participating in the challenge for them to join a skeptical group?
It's unusual for them to have any kind of staying power.
Oh, interesting.
Because the James Randi forum is kind of a shark tank, and it's filled with skeptics who are constantly asking questions and pelting everyone with questions. And usually people who have paranormal claims get kind of sick of answering questions.
Right.
And Anita did not tire at all.
Now, she claimed that she was a medical dowser. What does that mean?
It means that that was one of her claims. She also claimed that she sees and speaks with ghosts, including the ghosts of our founding fathers, the ghosts of animals, including dinosaurs, and she can communicate with all of them. But the thing that she said she felt strongest and was her most powerful power, if you will, is to be able to look at a person fully clothed and diagnose all kinds of medical problems just by looking at them.
So basically a human x-ray machine.
Yes.
Or technically MRI, because it's soft tissue and x-rays don't really get the soft tissue. But
essentially what happened was her original claim was medical dowsing, and we did work with her for a little bit to try to come up with some sort of protocol that was reasonable to do, because we knew it was going to involve human subjects. So that quickly kind of fell to the wayside when it became clear there really was no good way to set this up, at which point she decided to get involved with a local skeptical group in her area. And it was actually her interaction with that group called FACT.
It's the Forsyth Area Critical Thinkers in North Carolina.
They kind of set her straight, and we suspect that after speaking with them, she realized she needed to boil her claim down to something that was somehow more testable, and that's where the kidney detection, the human MRI aspect of her claim came into being.
Okay, so the test itself ended up being 3 rounds of 6 subjects, 1 missing a kidney in each group. And Anita had to identify which subject was missing which kidney.
Correct. And to state it more carefully, mm-hmm. we were essentially offering her 12 potential kidneys. It was not about finding the person and then guessing whether it was left or right. The idea was that there are 12 potential kidneys. One of those slots is going to be empty. Take a look. If you see kidneys, great. If you don't see one, that's probably your target.
Okay, so we actually have a question submitted via the website.
Yes, scientific testing usually involves multiple runs of testing for statistical reasons. The website suggests only a single test will be done, with the possibility of another test if necessary. Would the guests wish to comment?
Well, I mean, there's a whole lot of logistical problems. I mean, we're a volunteer organization with not, you know, $1 million budget to get tons and tons and tons of volunteers. So we had to create a test as best we could do, given limited resources. And I mean, let's face it, try to go out there and find a lot of people with missing a kidney. It's not an easy task. So, since I was the wrangler, I was tasked with getting all of the volunteers. It was, believe it or not, harder to get people to sign up that had 2 kidneys than the people that had 1 kidney. But you know, and trying to be double blind, what we were as close as possible. We realized we couldn't really truly double blind it, but as close as possible, we left it just to myself to get all those volunteers. Although Jim Newman and Steve and other people would say, "Hey, I heard a friend of a friend. You know, they're missing a kidney. Can they contact you?" So basically, I was the only one that had this information going in, but it's a very difficult task, and just logistically it's very, very difficult to set this kind of thing up. But that's why we did 3 groups of 6 people, total of 18, and you know, statistically it was 1 in about 1,728 to get all 3. So we said, if you have this power, you need to have all 3 100% correct. I think Jim has a little comment on it.
Yes, I think the listener, your points explain how it worked with Anita, but I think the listener may have been asking generically why just one test, mm-hmm. and then maybe they get to go on to the 50,000. And I think the answer is there rarely is just one test. Like with Anita, we have 3 different trials. If someone comes in and claims that they can predict the flip of a coin, we're not just going to do it once, and if they get it wrong, say, sorry, you're out of luck. There will be a series of trials that they'll have to go through. So we do kind of do that.
So what were the odds that she could have guessed correctly all 3 times? Like all 3 the same people, correct kidney?
If you were to just guess 1 out of the 3, the odds are about
4.5.
Yeah, was it? Well, say it comes out to be like 23% or something like that.
Okay.
Odds. And if you get 2, it's like 1 in 51. But to get all 3 right, it's about 1 in 1,728. So that's why, you know, we can't just leave it to some chance. And the other thing, interestingly, here, this is a very important point. Once we all started researching this whole thing about kidneys, because it's a very specific claim, we also found out that if you're a donator, in other words, if you've donated a kidney, something like 95-98% probability it's going to be from the left side.
Really?
Because there's a longer renal artery on the left kidney, and the right kidney is surrounded by the liver and other organs. So for the surgeon, it's much easier to remove the left kidney. So I had it in my mind that if this person was trying to just cheat, then if it were me, I would certainly just guess left every time. So what I did specifically was I found people with missing, 2 people were missing right kidneys, and I figured that was kind of a safeguard against just guessing left. If she had the power, clearly she's going to see the right kidney is missing. Oddly enough, the guesses were left, the left kidney, each and every time.
So you guys actually went to great lengths with
this. You have no idea.
Now, I was able to watch this on Ustream while it was actually being demonstrated live. And honestly, I was struck by the amount of work that was obviously put into this. But so this is something that Anita agreed to. All these protocols, she agreed ahead of time.
It was her idea.
Right.
She came to us. It was after Connie Sohn. I don't know if you remember her. She took a test in Las Vegas with James Randi last year.
With the $1 million challenge.
Yes, for the $1 million challenge. Mm-hmm. And she just had to guess playing cards. But the protocol that we came up with, or that Anita came up with, was essentially that same protocol, but instead of playing cards and envelopes, it was kidneys inside people. And
fascinating.
The protocol was very simple.
So what we did was we had to figure out how to actually do it in practical terms, because we were using human subjects and so forth. So that certainly added an element to it that that kind of permeated the entire endeavor, because you kept having to go back to, how do we do this with humans? One of the things we realized early on was that we did not want it to be a guessing game for her to simply look at a group of people and say, that person's missing a kidney. We took the premise that if you're truly seeing inside the human body, you should be able to see whether it's the right kidney or left kidney missing. And that goes back to, as I was saying, we really just needed human vessels to set in front of her and say, there's X amount of kidneys to be seen there. So that was a little different than what she may have wanted to begin with, but she couldn't really not accept that, because her claim was clearly to be seeing inside the human body. There was no question about that.
Right. Again, if you're listening live on CJSR and you have questions about the Independent Investigations Group or the Anita Ikonen Challenge, we will most happily take your call. The number is 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. We are also taking questions from the Ustream chat room, so if you're in there, ask away.
Desiree, one thing I thought I would add is that Anita was taking the preliminary, so $50,000 was not on the line.
Right.
In case there's any concern, question about that. Because you have to remember that, unlike James Randi, who asks that the applicants have some sort of media presence and have established themselves and their claim in some other forum, We're seeing people for the very first time.
Absolutely.
So any test or demonstration we would set up, we have to calibrate that. And in this case, had she passed, we would have been obligated to go forward and create another test that would be for the 50K. And I think it's safe to say it would have had a larger randomization aspect and so on in terms of a test.
That would have been a logistical nightmare for me, but for all of us. But literally, we would have had to have gotten many more people that were missing a kidney, what we came to refer to as the unikidneys. And we would have had to have gotten, I don't know what the odds are, but we would have had to have gotten like 8 or 9 or 10 unikidneys and just that many more bikidneyed people to come and sit. It would have been just a nightmare. So only on that level, I mean, if Anita is truly psychic, or she was, that would be wonderful. But on that level, I was just so hoping we didn't have to go through it again. It was such a nightmare.
Spencer, actually, you've mentioned these subjects a couple of times. How does one go about recruiting one-kidneyed people?
Well, you know, I just happened to get the first one, and because I happen to have a friend that's a transplant surgeon, but he's down in San Diego. We're in Los Angeles, you know, it's a 2-hour drive, so I didn't think he really knew anybody locally, but I thought I'd start with him, and so I contacted him. I said, hey, John, do you know any, you know, people that are missing a kidney, being a transplant surgeon? And he said, yeah, you know, actually, I do know somebody. And sort of as an aside, an odd coincidence, I went to school with this guy's uncle. It just happened to be one of those weird connections. But anyway, the I contacted him, and he was very willing to do it. He was a bit of a skeptic himself, and so we met for dinner, and then it went from there. And Jim Newman turned on a lot of names to me, and friends of friends of friends, you know, and we finally just figured out how to get these people.
Basically, if you start a conversation at a party with, do you know anyone who's missing a kidney? You have the most interesting conversation at the party, and everyone wants to talk to you.
That is brilliant, sir.
So it was an interesting endeavor, which actually carried on into the day of the actual testing, because we were in trying to recruit people, you didn't want to give them too much information about what was actually happening,
right,
in our attempt to try to keep some sort of blinding in place. So Spencer, as he would speak to people, would ask them in passing if they happened to have an organ missing. But in fact, we were looking for kidneys, but we didn't even want them to know that. So there was a little bit of subterfuge that had to be built into the process, which carried on right until the day of the testing when they were upstairs, because we, of course, wanted to keep our subjects in the dark as much as possible about what the claimant was looking for.
So Jim even had this whole ruse upstairs. It was great. I wish I had this on video, but he said, okay, we're going to throw a six-sided die, and depending on the number that it lands on, it'll be some kind of organ missing or a person that's whole and not missing anything. And so you guys know who you are, as if, you know, everybody in the room was missing a different kind of organ, you know? And so we were just really trying to keep people off balance so they didn't, so it was kind of as double blind as possible, really, was what we were going for.
Oh, I love this.
People wouldn't be sitting on the stage and fidgeting and thinking, if she said, oh, wow, she chose me, well, maybe the die said it was supposed to be a person that wasn't missing anything. That's why she chose me, because I'm not missing anything. You know, so we were really trying to just kind of keep it secret and under wraps and double blind as much as possible.
And you mentioned
you would not want someone coming on stage feeling nervous because they happen to know they are the target.
Right.
That was our goal.
Because they'll relay that in their body language, I assume.
Well, potentially, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They right, will. Perhaps, and in ways that we could never anticipate,
right.
So the best thing was to keep them in the dark.
So we did our best. We did our best to convince everyone in the room that everyone else was missing an organ, except there were a couple special people who had all their organs. But really, everyone had all their organs, and only a few people were missing kidneys.
So you mentioned that that they would have to sit on the stage. Now, Anita was able to view each subject for 4.5 minutes. So
Correct. Each
subject had to stand there for a total of 27 minutes with a
Absolutely. Cloth
over their
sitting.
Head?
They were sitting. They didn't have
right.
to stand.
Okay, so sitting in public with a cloth over their head.
Right. We had these very fashionable pith helmet kind of things, and we had a cloth draped around their head, so it would just sort of obscure their face from the side and the back of their head. And then we also went out and bought these light blue t-shirts so everybody was completely uniform, at least from the waist up. We asked all people to wear pants, whether they were male or female. And so basically from the rear, she just saw a light blue shirt and this helmet and cloth over the head. And so, you know, that way the conditions were completely the same for everybody.
So did anybody besides you, Spencer, know initially who was missing the kidneys?
No, I mean, obviously the participant that was missing the kidney, but mm-hmm. nobody knew except me, not even Jim Underdown on stage. Not one person in that whole building except me knew who was missing a kidney, who was not, and who the correct target was. Now, Jim Underdown, who was down on stage, he slipped a little note to a runner we had who ran upstairs, and he would show me, this was her guess, and I wrote a little M for miss or H for hit, and then I would send the runner back down. But basically,
the reason for that was so that, and it was in the protocol, that if we felt there was any aspect of the protocol that was in question, or if there was any sensory leakage or anything we could correct for, we'd want to know as soon as possible. At the same time, Jim Underdown did not want to know any more than he needed to know. So in this case, it was that last trial a hit or not? And that was all he did know.
Yeah. So and even keeping Jim Underdown in the dark was important because, you know, it's potentially he's a source of sensory leakage. I mean, he probably wouldn't, but you know, potentially yes. So he might hesitate just a little bit more, or stare at somebody a little bit more, or something like that. So even Jim Underdown on stage did not know who was missing a kidney, and that's how we designed it. We try to be as double blind as best as possible, just for all those reasons.
Right, and you were also very concerned about anybody being able to dispute the results of the test afterwards.
Right, that was anyone who does this sort of testing knows that that's in many ways the biggest problem, because your subject, or in this case your claimant, would be able to poke holes in some aspect of it. And I think it's a testament to how well we did that Anita accepts that she missed on the trials she missed, and is not disputing any aspect in terms of how the protocol was done. But yes, it was foremost in our minds to, as I kind of described it, we wanted to, you know, we couldn't necessarily guarantee anything, but we wanted to put enough nails in the coffin so that she could not come back and dispute it. And if the nails were approved by her, better yet. So we tried as much as possible to do it the way Anita wanted to do it, so that even that aspect, she couldn't come back and say she'd been forced to do anything in any fashion that was not, you know, not to her best advantage.
And you went so far as to actually contract a professional ultrasound machine and technician.
Yes, because it's possible that we could have recruited someone that we thought had two kidneys, and the person themselves thought that they had two kidneys, but they might have been born with one and never had known about it. Now, if Anita had chosen that person, she would have been right, but there would be no way to verify it. So we actually did hire an ultrasound technician and a machine, and so each of her selections was ultrasounded to prove whether they had one or two kidneys.
It was also important to us that, again, going back to the previous question, that there be nothing to be able to dispute. And we realized early on that to ask a potential target to, oh, and by the way, can you bring a note from your medical doctor and your x-rays proving that right. You were missing a kidney, yada, yada, that would be a big hardship on even finding people. We're already asking enough of people to come down for that much time. And it finally just boiled down to, we have to have hard and fast proof contemporaneously happening right there. And that was the way to do it. And Anita agreed to it. And to her credit, we were able to put the entire demonstration together with that pretty much indisputable verification at the end.
And
I
was actually just going to tell people that we'd be right back to talk about exactly how Anita did right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we take an in-depth look at the recent Lancet retraction of Andrew Wakefield's research into a correlation between autism and MMR vaccine. Pharmacist Scott Guevara, research ethicist Nancy Walton, and author and philosopher Chris McDonald explore the shoddy science, questionable ethics, and repercussions of more than a decade of misinformation. And on Speaking Up, Rodrigo de la Gera of the Greater Edmonton Skeptical Society on the value of basic research. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And I'm on the line with Spencer Marks, Jim Newman, and Steve Muscarella, all members of the Independent Investigations Group out of Hollywood, California. And we're talking about how the Anita Iconin $50,000 challenge, we're actually about to find out if Anita passed the test. I already know. As I said, I saw it on Ustream. But I'm sure the rest of you are on pins and needles. So I'll keep you in suspense for a moment longer. Derek Bartholomew, the IIG member I mentioned earlier, who's the lead on the Billy Meyer case, he's actually called with some news of his own. Hi, Derek.
Hello.
So what do you have to tell us?
We have, this is exciting. After 10 years of the Independent Investigations Group's existence, we are excited. excited to announce the forming of IIG affiliates at the local Centers for Inquiry. The Los Angeles IIG will serve as the advisor to all of the new IIG affiliates. The first one is being launched at the Washington, D.C. Center for Inquiry on Saturday, March 13th. The launch will begin with a seminar by Ben Radford entitled Scientific Paranormal Investigations, How to Solve Unexplained Mysteries. Immediately afterwards, Jim Underdown and Brian Hart will discuss the creation of the new IIG DC and how anyone can learn to investigate claims of the paranormal from a rational and scientific viewpoint. And you can go to centerforinquiry.net/DC for more information about that.
So what does this mean? Does this mean that there's going to be other $50,000 challenges around the U.S.?
What we're looking at, the prize challenge is absolutely going to continue, and it's going to be available to each of these affiliates. We're still working with the Center for Inquiry, though technically this is actually falling under CSI, the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry.
Right.
About what the prize challenge amount is going to be. It will probably still be $50,000. It may be more than that. This is the 10-year anniversary of the IIG, and this is something that we had been discussing with the Center for Inquiry for the past year, and we're very happy to see that they want to go forward with it.
Brilliant. I'm very pleased. This IIG is a fantastic organization, and I've had nothing but great conversation with you guys, and you're doing a lot of good work. So,
oh, thank you so much.
Yeah, congrats. And thank you very much for the information. Where can people find out more?
centerforinquiry.net/DC.
Perfect. So back to Anita. Steve, how did she do?
She guessed correctly on trial number two and guessed incorrectly on trial number one and trial number three. She had at the beginning made a point of saying to us that she was not going to guess, that she didn't see something and get some impression she would just pass. We made it clear to her that a pass was still a miss, and she assured us that she understood that. And I bring that up because ultimately she did, in fact, put a choice down for each of the three trials, and she got one of them right. We were very surprised that she got the one right, but it was certainly within the odds of chance. If we had pulled one person off the street, out of four people pulled off the street, one of them would have guessed the same as she did. So it was not remarkable by any
okay.
stretch.
So what was her explanation for not being able to get the 3 out of 3?
She basically says that when she's right, she's right. You know, that maybe her power doesn't work all the time under all circumstances, but when she feels it, she's right. She said she felt it for the one that she got right and did not feel it on the other two.
Now, of course, our response to that is, considering that the test was designed so she would be wrong more often than right, it seems like a specious argument to make.
Right.
Yes, well, if she was just guessing.
Well, remember, that's designed to be wrong if you're just guessing. The test should be not designed to be wrong if you can truly see these kidneys, you know, of course. We're not designing in some kind of, you know, failure specifically if you really truly have the power.
So she felt it was somehow interesting that she was so sure that she was wrong in trial number one and so sure she was wrong in trial number three, and we don't seem to agree that that's actually very remarkable.
Okay, now one of the things that I find most interesting about this is you mentioned earlier the Connie Son challenge through the James Randi Educational Foundation, the $1 million challenge. Now, when she wasn't able to complete her challenge, she initially seemed okay, but The next day? She was talking about the challenge being rigged and all of these issues.
Exactly, and that goes back to what I was saying, is that that's the shoe that always drops after you do the test. And at first she seemed quite gracious about it, but within 24 hours she was trying to imply that everything was not on the up and up, that Banachek was a professional magician, all of which she knew ahead of time and had agreed to. Banachek was not a surprise. She knew who he was. She had been told who he was and why he was administering the test, being someone who's worked with James Randi for many years. So, but once she kind of got wind that she might be able to make the argument that Banachek had somehow used sleight of hand as he removed cards from envelopes, she went there, so to speak, and we were sort of disappointed because I think all of us were rather impressed with her that she had come and stepped up to the plate. Anita did the same, and we're very pleased that she's willing to step up to test her claim as well.
But Anita was very gracious. So
yeah, I have to say, one thing that is remarkable about Anita is that in all of this time that has passed, she has always actually defended the IIG, and even against other Wu kind of people, Anita has always in writing said, no, you're wrong, the IIG did not cheat me, they did a wonderful job, these guys were great, and it was a fair test, and I failed it fair and square. I mean, so in her, you know, to her credit, she's really not done what Connie Sana did, and I think that's pretty incredible.
So I'm just wondering now, not to cast aspersions or anything, but when people approach you to do this kind of challenge, because you don't approach them,
that's correct.
Do you feel like maybe you should be doing some kind of psychological testing? Because there's a difference because the thing is, and I want to clarify, because Anita seemed like a very nice, very sane woman.
Yes.
But I definitely assume that you are approached by people who may not be in that frame of mind. And
I suppose, an ethical tightrope that we do have to walk there, which we struggle with often as we talk about going forward. We have to deal with each claimant on a case-by-case basis, but it does enter our minds, and whenever possible, we try to err on the side of making sure we're not exploiting someone who perhaps isn't in control of all their faculties.
And most people who approach us who seem to really have the need of a mental health professional, they usually vanish fairly quickly. They just disappear. They stop communicating with us.
Right.
Some are a little more persistent and keep saying that they're going to come and take a test, but they never show up, and they keep saying, well, next month I can get my truck working and drive to California for you, but it never happens. They just tend not to show up.
So you have another challenge on the roster, I hear. Can you actually say anything about it, or is it too soon at this point?
No, we actually can, because we have posted on our website information about it, and people can even go there and read the protocol. It's a much easier test than Anita Ikonen. We're dealing with playing cards again, but at this time it's a telepath, and he has been in touch with us, and he's got his bus ticket to Los Angeles, and we'll be there on February 20th,
yes,
a week from tomorrow.
And we are going to be streaming the video again.
Brilliant.
So we encourage everyone to come and take a look.
And that the link to the website will definitely be posted on Skeptically Speaking as well. And I will be watching that you stream, because I was fascinated by the last one. Honestly, you guys were rigid in your protocol. And as someone who is rigid in their protocol, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thanks so much to Spencer Marks, Jim Newman, and Steve Muscarella for being here today.
Thank you, Desiree.
Thank you.
And you can find out more about the Independent Investigations Group at iigwest.com. And you can find out more about the show at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, you can join our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, or subscribe to the show in iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan. Woo, I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus, locus, erode.